My guest is Dr. Gerard Verschuren. He's been with us before. He is the author of many books, including How Science Points to God, which is going to be our focus today. He's a scientist, he's a writer, speaker, a consultant. He's been working at this interface of science and religion, creation and evolution, faith and reason, for a long time. By training, he's a biologist. He has studied, worked at universities in Europe and the United States. And he's the author of books, A Catholic Scientist Proves God Exists, Matters of Life and Death, A Catholic Guide to the Moral Questions of Our Time. And today, we're talking about his book, How Science Points to God. Dr. Verschuren, thanks for joining me. It's good to have you again.
Thank you, Al, for inviting me on to be on your show.
Well, let's start with the whole scientific enterprise itself. It's been said by many historians of science that science rests upon assumptions that really emerge from a Christian understanding of life, the idea that there's a rational God who's created a rational universe, and creatures in his own image who can understand this. Talk to us about how science itself, the enterprise itself, is dependent upon our understanding of God.
Yes, as you said correctly, science has assumptions. Most scientists don't want to hear about that, so they ignore it. But you can't stay silent for the rest of your life about it.
Right.
So there must be something with those assumptions. In my book, I talk about at least five of them. One of them is that there is an objectively real world. Otherwise, science is just a matter of fiction if there is no real world.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is comprehensible.
Yes.
Even Albert Einstein said that. Otherwise, science would not be possible. If we cannot comprehend the world because it is chaos or we can't understand it, then there is no science possible. Mm-hmm. And also that our perception through eyes, ears, and hands is in essence reliable. Otherwise, science is not reliable.
Right.
And I think there is order in nature.
Mm-hmm.
The sun will rise every morning, though we may not always see it. It will arise. We don't have to be surprised every morning that the sun is there again. So science has to accept that. Science can prove quite a bit, but I'm very skeptical how much it can prove.
Mm-hmm.
But it can never prove its own assumptions. It has to assume them before science can even get off the ground.
Yes.
That is a clear indication, I would say, that it points to God. For where does that come from, that real world? Where do the laws of nature come from? Did they just pop up? That's hard to believe. That is magic.
Right.
And there is nothing magic in this world. So we have to say to everyone, and you talked in the beginning about the warfare, the lie, the myth, that there is a clash between science and religion. Well, we need that religion in order to let science even get started.
Exactly.
In the 15th, 16th century, almost all scientists were religious believers.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, when I tell people that I am a human geneticist and a believer, they look at me like, are you right? Is that possible? They see a conflict, and I keep saying there is no conflict. It's actually a very harmonious relationship. I sometimes call it a match made in heaven.
Yes.
We need religion in order to do science. Science can do a lot, but it cannot prove its own assumptions. That is a long answer to a short question.
No, very good. You write about the physical constants in our universe. What are these physical constants, and how do they point to God?
Oh, I find them very important and very powerful. We have four basic forces in nature: gravity, electromagnetism, weak nuclear interactions, and strong nuclear interactions. Where do those forces come from? If they were slightly different, I prove in my book that a lot of things in this world would be very different and some would not even be possible. If the strength of gravity, for instance, were not based on the inverse square of the distance, sorry for that technical language, then the orbits of the planets in the solar system would be much more complicated than ellipses, or circles as some say, but it's really a matter of ellipses. And otherwise our solar system would collapse, basically. So we need that gravity law. It's a law of nature. And the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, and the electromagnetic force, as if they would have been a little different, the universe would have had a very different outcome. And probably we would not be on this Earth. There would not be human life. Of course, scientists say that's a matter of coincidence. And they come up with all kinds of explanations, like Hawkins. He died not too long ago. Mm-hmm. He was a famous astrophysicist. But he came up with a weird explanation. He said there must have been multiple universes.
Yeah.
And one of them happens to be the one that we can live in.
Yeah.
Well, where does that idea come from? From Hawkins.
Right.
He found it out on his own. But there is no... How can you prove that there are multiple universes? That is impossible. You cannot step outside your own universe. He does so happily, because he is a good physicist, but not a great philosopher. So I would rather refer to the Book of Wisdom that says, God, you have arranged all things by measure and number and weight. And the physical constants have been arranged by God according to that measure, to that number, and that weight, and that's why we can exist in this universe. Yeah. Again, that was a little bit technical, but your audience can handle that easily.
I'm sure. This, how unlikely is it that there would be a life-affirming universe or a life-possible universe? It's not very likely, right?
I don't find it very likely, and because it requires a lot of conditions.
Right.
And, and for those conditions to be found, Hawking would say, oh, yeah, find one in another planet, in another solar system or whatever. But why? Why do we need all of that?
Right.
We have to realize that everything on Earth is ruled by laws of nature. And those laws of nature, yeah, there we go again, where do they come from? They didn't just pop up. They came from God. And thanks to those laws of nature, certain things are possible and certain things are not possible. So we can say on this planet that there are certain laws that have to be fulfilled. So there must be something on this Earth that causes that. There is a famous periodic system that regulates everything from the from helium through uranium, all the 92 elements that we find on this world. That is a very strict system. Certain combinations of molecules are not possible, certain compounds are not possible, and some are very likely, thanks to the periodic system. So I would say, when we go through, if I may jump to the issue of evolution, evolution was not just a haphazard event.
Right.
It works, as some say, with natural selection. Whether you believe that or not, even if you believe that, natural selection does not work haphazardly. It has to select what is successful. And things that are not really successful on this Earth will not make it in evolution. So that's why I say that we have to follow those laws. A heart that does not follow hydrodynamic laws for pumping blood cannot be very successful. And, fish that don't follow hydrodynamic laws, or birds that don't follow laws of movement, they cannot be successful. So the path of evolution is not as weird as some people think. It follows, I always like to use that image, it follows a path of least resistance. Some things are very unlikely, have a high resistance, so the river cannot follow a path of high resistance. Water will never flow upwards.
Right.
So it has to follow the topographic design of the landscape, and so does the stream of evolution. It follows a path somehow regulated by the laws of nature and the design of the universe. Where does that design come from? You feel it coming.
Yeah.
From the Creator.
Right, right. Yeah.
He made everything possible. He designed the bed in which the stream of evolution meanders. So, is it random? Not really. And besides, randomness is something that we have to be very careful with. I always refer to Padre Pio, who always used to say, everyone who says that something is a matter of coincidence, I always ask, whom do you think regulated that coincidence?
Right,
It's God.
Yes.
It's God. And even Thomas Aquinas, our famous philosopher in the Catholic Church, he said, everyone who only believes in randomness, in chance, is not really a believer.
Yes.
So
right.
I always protest when I hear a scientist say, oh, that is randomness. But of course, they have the right to say that as a scientist, but as long as they don't claim that that's the final truth.
That's right. That's the final controlling element. Dr. Mashirin, hold it there. We'll take a break. We'll come right back and look at the Big Bang. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Gerard Mashirin, author most recently of How Science Points to God. We've been looking at various aspects of the scientific enterprise, certain discoveries of science. And let's go to one which is relatively new in terms of discovery, the middle of the 20th century, the idea of the Big Bang. You've heard the idea that there's this Big Bang. You may even know that a Catholic priest had an essential role in helping to discover and confirm it. He was a Belgian priest, astronomist, and physicist, Father George Lemaître, at Catholic University of Louvain. When I was still in college, this hadn't been quite settled, at least according to my undergraduate physics teacher, who still thought there was something to be said for what used to be called the steady-state theory of the universe. And Dr. Mashirin, let me ask you, when was the Big Bang finally, when did it finally reach, become dominant in the minds of astrophysicists?
As you said, it's rather recent, but the weird thing is that the term Big Bang came from Fred Hoyle.
Huh,
he was a firm atheist, and he mocked at it by applying that name. It was not a compliment. He just said, oh, that's the Big Bang, because he was really a guy who believed in a steady state.
Right, right.
Where came that idea come from? Basically from Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein, and he is not the first one in physics, he is a famous one, so I'm very careful to blame Einstein, but I have to. he came up with that eternal universe. He thought there was no beginning and no end. It had always been that way. Fortunately, Einstein was big enough to later say that was his biggest blunder he ever made, because he finally had to face the fact that Edwin Hubble measured in 1929 that there was a cosmic expansion. I won't go into detail how he measured that, but as long as we realize that there was a cosmic expansion, that means that the Earth had been a very tiny thing in space in the beginning, and it will expand and expand and expand. So he came up basically with that idea, but where came the idea from that this is expanding? Not from Fred Hoyle, not from Einstein, but from, as you said already, Father Lemaître.
Mm-hmm.
He was the priest from Belgium, so I'm Sorry, I'm a little biased. I'm from Holland, so I always feel close to him.
Right.
He was teaching at the French-speaking part of the University of Leuven or Louvain, and he came up with the idea that there was something like a Big Ben. Again, that word was not his, that came later from Fred Hoyle. So, actually, Albert Einstein was horrified when he heard that. He said, this is unbelievable. There is no way that that can be true. But, as I said already, he finally said, I made a big mistake. Father Lemaître was right. And so I have to say, and we have to be honest about everything, in 2018, the members of the International Astronomical Union voted overwhelmingly to recommend that the famous Hubble Law of Edwin Hubble in 1929 that described the expansion of the universe would from now on be called the Hubble-Lemaître Law.
Huh.
Ooh,
wow.
That is quite a compliment for Father Lemaître, Catholic, a priest. I'd like to quote one of his sayings where he says, I have no conflict to reconcile. You talked about the conflict before.
Yeah.
Science has not shaken my faith in religion, and religion has never caused me to question the conclusions I reached by scientific methods.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the end of the warfare myth, the end of the conflict theory. I hope you agree.
Yes, I was a real, again, when I was an undergraduate, there was still talk of it, but, in recent years, it seems to me, those who try to maintain this idea of a conflict between science and religion are not themselves historians of science. They're novelists, filmmakers, popular speakers, and there are a few adamant atheists who, for personal reasons, like to drive a wedge between science and faith, but serious historians of science just don't do that.
No, but those atheists like to keep the conflict myth going and going and going.
Yep.
And unfortunately, you were talking about teachers, professors, and stuff like that. Many of them have never gotten that far yet. They are good scientists, but they never learned how to philosophize on it and how to see that there is a deeper dimension to life than that. So they keep, as I always say, they keep portraying that myth, and unfortunately students are the victims.
You work in the field of genetics. Tell us a little bit of how genetics points to God. We also have an important Catholic figure in the history of genetics, too, with Gregor Mendel. But go ahead and tell us how genetics points to God.
Yeah, they call Mendel always the father of genetics. He was one of the first ones who worked with that kind of approach. And again, a priest, a monk. I don't really think he was a priest, but
he was definitely
an Augustinian monk.
That's right, I think you're right, right.
Yeah, so he started the whole thing, and since then, things have taken off quite a bit. It took 50 years before genetics really started to blossom with genes, alleles, chromosomes, and stuff like that. But it is basically since 1953 that genetics really took off, because at that time, the DNA molecule was unraveled.
Mm-hmm.
And the DNA molecule has often been called the secret of life. Well, DNA is not a secret of life. DNA can't do anything on itself. If you put DNA in a test tube, it can't do anything.
Yeah.
It's like a dead piece of text that needs to be read and to make sense. A virus, and we are talking about viruses all the time nowadays, a virus even is not alive. It is a DNA or RNA molecule in a protein code. A coat.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs a cell to grow into. So viruses go into human cells, for instance, in the case of the China virus.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it goes into a bacteria or whatever. So they need the machinery of life, of a cell. So I would say the cell is the secret of DNA. DNA is not the secret of life. Mm-hmm. But still, DNA is powerful. It regulates the proteins we make in our body, and we all need proteins. Enzymes are proteins. So you cannot metabolize things if you don't have the right proteins. So that's why I can see that people say DNA is an important molecule. Yes, yes, yes. But it needs much more than DNA. It needs everything around it. So some have called DNA, it is a language of information.
Mm-hmm.
And information is not a chemical concept. There is no information in the molecule, basically. But DNA does have information. So where does that information come from?
Yeah.
The famous man who was in charge of the genome project, Collins, Francis Collins,
mm-hmm.
He was a very dedicated Christian. He was so Christian that when he was going to be assigned to that project, a lot of people protested, as they are doing now with a new chief justice, a potential chief
yes.
justice. They say,
yes.
How can a Christian, or let alone a Catholic, how can they be doing something for the government? Well, Francis Collins did. So he said, we have a code of God. It's the language of God, as he called it. And one of his books has that title.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice to read. I recommend it highly. I refer to it in my book, The Pointers to God, Science Points to God. It points to God each time we have a new generation coming. We don't have to start everything from scratch, nor does God have to start everything from scratch. He uses the information of the DNA code to get us started. And so where does the DNA code come from? From previous DNA? Yes. But it's also coming from God. Is that a conflict? Of course not.
Right.
God uses the DNA code just as he uses the laws of nature to make things happen in this world. So I always say children come through the laws of genetics and of DNA from their parents. But ultimately, they come from God. It doesn't make sense to create a conflict there. If I say they come from parents, that does not mean they cannot come from God.
No.
There is no conflict. There is no warfare there. It would be a conflict if I say they come from parents or they come from the stork. That's a conflict.
Right.
Either
right.
one is true. No, there is only one true. But you can come from parents and you can come from God. It is through the parents that God creates new human beings.
I want to return. I'm sorry, go right ahead.
Yeah, made in the image of God, as the book of Genesis says.
Yes.
We are all made in his image.
I want to go back to something you said earlier when you were talking about evolution, and that is this idea of randomness, which some people think of as pure chance. When it looks as though natural selection operates according to randomness, random according to who? In other words, doesn't the idea of randomness have a technical meaning in evolutionary studies? It doesn't mean the same kind of randomness that would displace God. Because some people think of randomness, they think of, well, if it's random, it means God can have nothing to do with it. If it's pure chance, God can have nothing to do with it.
Correct, yeah. That's what they think.
Yeah.
yeah. But there is a big difference. You are right in saying that. So what I would like to just mention very briefly that Thomas Aquinas speaks of two kind of causes. The secondary causes are the causes we know from science. That is how molecules create new molecules, how DNA creates new DNA, etc. But there is all those causes can't do anything if there is no first cause. Well, randomness in science is a term that is very, very correct, very scientific. And it says something about how secondary causes cause other causes that can sometimes be random. Even Thomas Aquinas says that there is chance in nature.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also randomness that some people use as the ultimate ruler of life and of this universe. But then they are replacing God
right.
with a new deity.
That's right.
The deity of randomness, of chance. I always say that is chance with a capital C. Well, there is no chance with a capital C. Chance is just a scientific concept. And as Stephen Barr, who is a particle physicist,
mm-hmm.
I borrowed from him the important distinction. You could say I stole it from him, but I'd rather say I borrowed it from him. He said, randomness in science is how secondary causes cause each other.
Mm-hmm.
That can be random.
Yes.
But the randomness that some people talk about is about how are things related to God. And God is the ruler of everything. In the eyes of God, nothing is random.
Right.
God is all-knowing, all-present. He knows what is going to happen and what has happened. So there is nothing random in that sense.
Very good.
The people who confuse those two are basically making a big philosophical...
Dr. Verschuren, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Once again, great talking with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.